There's an underlying spirit of competitiveness, yes, on the field of play.
Sure.
Yep. But off the field of play, it is this warm, collaborative environment that we're all deeply embedded in the belief that the world is a better place for sport. And our role is helping to make the world a better place through sport. So that belief in the higher purpose is what unites us in the work that we do and helps us to, you know, work together. So a lot of people don't know, but even on this, on the field of play, we will partner with other countries to help our athletes. Mm. I'm working on Milana Cortina at the moment, and we're obviously not big in winter sports as much as we are in the summer sports. So we work with Norwegian wax technicians to wax our skis, and then we'll have someone that's a performance analyst that'll stand on the course and clock the athlete as they go past. So we'll help the Norwegians, Norwegians will help us. So countries do collaborate and work together, even though we are competitors.
Yes.
And it's a message for people in other sectors and other industries where you think your greatest competitor might not be someone that you can partner with, but there is more that you can do together than what you can sometimes do individually.
Look, it's funny as well because this happens in many other contexts. As a former military soldier, you know, the same things happen across allied countries, like the friendships and mateships you have by, forging relationships, doing things that are difficult together, visiting countries that you've never been to before. Those friendships last a lifetime. And quite ironically, the friendships start in a very compressed time. You don't have all of your childhood to make the friendship. You have a very short amount of time, and that overarching galvanizing force just brings that friendship to life. And it creates a memory, which I'm convinced is something which is quite marvelous about sport and serving and all the other things, but it's really something.
It is. And what you've just experienced in the military setting, which is you go in, you execute, and you leave, yeah? Mm. Execute as an executor plan, not.
Yep.
And the Olympic Games are actually very similar to that. You go in with your 400 teammates, mm-hmm. you compete, and then you come back. So that idea of going in and being in the trenches together, and it's damn hard work in the Olympic yep. Village during Olympic Games because you're there to service and help every athlete give the best performance of their life. But you are shoulder to shoulder with people from other countries that are trying to do the same thing for their athletes. And, the friendships that you build, both with the IOC and other countries, the allied countries is very strong, even in the sports sector, where we say, can we use your cleaners? And like going to Rio was a classic where the village basically wasn't built when we moved in there. So the IOC didn't solve it. Rio Organising Committee didn't solve it. We were like, the planes were coming, the athletes were coming, and like the village still wasn't built. We're like, we're going to solve this ourselves. National Olympic Committees got together and said, okay, you bring the cleaners, we'll bring the plumbers, we'll bring the craftsmen. All used our embassies and said, let's solve this together. It was only through partnering and dividing and conquering together that we kind of got to the start line of Rio.
And meanwhile, we're sitting at home watching the opening ceremony thinking everything's just fine.
No one will ever know.
It's amazing. So when you think about all of your legal training, some of the study you would have done in information technology, I mean, there has been such an advancement made across the board in technology as it relates to sport. But what are some of the things you took from that very early training that you had, maybe even as a lawyer, that have stood you in great stead as you've moved into the sports commissions, then across Austrade? And I'm asking this question because you'll have people listening to this who are in a process of reinvention. And we've sort of touched on this before, where the skills don't get left at the door, they just get translated into a new context. What is your insight around that? Because it feels to me central to this is your genuine capacity to want to bring people together, which is something that feels like it's very native to you as opposed to something that is a skill that needs to be learned.
Yeah, I think, we're the product of our experiences, and even if at the time if you're in a role, you're not really clear or sure on what skills you're learning, you are learning new and different skills that will help you in the next role. And I think as I transitioned from law into sport, I had to be able to articulate those transferable skills, and to have someone believe and connect the dots on your experiences that they're going to be relevant to the organisation you're going to. So, yes, I did an IT degree, and at the time I walked into the AOC, they didn't have much of an IT strategy. They had a bit of a website, but no real strategy around their going. So it happened to be opportune. Yes, right place, right time. Yes, I could lead the project management of the Olympic team and I had my legal experience, but I could also help in the IT space. So accumulating skills and experiences in different roles at the time might seem irrelevant, but when you look back in a future time, you'll be able to call on them. And the same then when I transitioned from sport into doing the nation branding work, you'd think, how do you go and lead a nation brand when you've not got any particular branding or marketing experience?
Yeah.
But you think about it, I sit in the middle of the Olympic Village. I'm working with 205 countries from around the world. There is no better way to understand how the rest of the world sees you, understand the cultures, understand how Australia is perceived by the rest of the world. I'm wearing a green and gold tracksuit, so I'm naturally incredibly patriotic about this beautiful country. Mm-hmm. It was really an exercise in bringing stakeholders together, and sport is one of those sectors that it is all about bringing people together with united vision and stakeholder management. So the skills were there, and then it takes convincing of an individual that's willing to open a door of opportunity for me and connect the dots. And I had that when I transitioned from law to sport at the AOC, and then I had it again when at Austrade, the CEO was willing to give me a chance to deliver this important project for our country.
Let's talk about that, Fiona, because the Australian national brand. Now, I remember I made the Australian team for triathlon in 2004, and when I received my kit, I don't think I've had a prouder unpacking, unboxing experience in my life. Like,
yeah, it's delightful, isn't it?
It is absolutely so profound. It is.
I remember
it is
the same. It's so special.
Something else. Something
having
else.
Having Australia on your bum is something special.
It is. Absolutely it is. And, you know, when we talk about the Australian National Brand Project, so just in case people don't know what this is, and I'm sure you give us some more detail, it spanned 17 government departments, 50-plus industries, and your job was to help Australia have an identity. Mm. So how did you bring all these people together to ultimately get to a place where people went, we're good for this?
Yeah, okay, and throw in there COVID when the rest of the world, when all the world is closed, yeah? It was a fascinating project. I love those big, bold, ambitious projects when people say you can't. Like when people say it's too big or you can't manage it, like I'm there, yeah? They're the challenges that are worth taking on.
100%.
So what you articulated about being a proud Australian, I think, is what so many of us do feel in Australia. But internationally, we are often irrelevant to the rest of the world. I hate to say it, but we are considered this wonderful, likable, we don't have like a likability or we don't have a likability problem. We've got a relevancy problem in Australia. Yeah. So people will like us and got a propensity or a favorability to kind of want to see us or buy a product, but we're just not relevant. So important to that project was actually framing up what's the problem we're trying to solve. Mm. So let me ask you this question, Phil. Okay, I'm going to say the name of a country and you're going to tell me the top thing that comes to mind, maybe top two things that come to mind. Ready?
Okay, I think I'm ready. Let's do it.
Switzerland.
Snow and currency.
As in money, bankers,
as in
yeah.
Money. Yep.
Okay, Brazil.
Heat and I've got two things that I'm splitting my mind on. Heat is one of them, and the other one is just outdoor fun and celebration.
Okay. Italy.
Food, man. Food, 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 fashion, and then more food.
Okay. So the things that you've articulated and those that be running around the heads of your listeners are usually one of three things that relate to the people, the place, all the products.
Right.
Now, if I say Australia, what do you think most people around the world would say?
Island, a long way away, strange accent, Paul Hogan, bridge, crocodiles, maybe Vegemite.
Yeah. And you're pretty accurate, okay? It's our people. It's the beautiful beaches, the cuddly koalas, the kangaroos, our furry animals and our deadly animals. But it's rarely ever is it a product or a service that we can provide to the world. So it's obviously it's anchored in people and place, but never products. When you spoke about Switzerland, it was about banking. Italy, it was about food. So if you work in global economies where selling stuff to other countries is how GDP grows, Australia's at a disadvantage, particularly when you have something like COVID, when tourism is such a big part of our economy. There's only so many people we can ship around the world.
Yes.
So being anchored in people and place is very limiting for an economy. Having products and services that the rest of the world want and willing to buy, that's where Australia needs to advance. And that was the genesis of the problem we're trying to solve when we look at our reputation as a country internationally. Again, it's not favorability or likability. Every country has got a different problem to solve, yeah? Yes. And ours in Australia is not that people don't want to come. It's that we're a long way away, pretty irrelevant, and I don't know any product or service that I'd ever want to buy. So that was the work that we kind of went about doing. And it took a while to actually frame the question.
Sure.
And then how we go about leading that, it takes coordination of lots of different sectors. So, yes, the tourism sector, the trade sector, the resources sector, the beer industry, the fashion industry, got captains of all of those industries to come together and lead and unite. None of them were paid a cent to do this. These are CEOs of some of Australia's great companies. You know, it's Alan Joyce at Qantas, it's Mike Campbell-Brooks at Atlassian, it's Christine Holgate at Australia Post, breweries, Vogue, really wonderful, wonderful, passionate leaders about our country. And it is remarkable, Phil, what people will do if they are asked.
Yeah? Yes, all correct. It took 100%.
Courage to say, we have this bold, big-ass ambition. Do you think you can help us? And I've become shameless in my career about asking people to do something.